Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are paper 43, section 5, which is old single column, page 490. All right. So they were, you recall last time we did the, you know, the previous section last time, they were giving us a little bit about the Faithful of Days that is there to advise the Most Highs. And they were very much leveraging off of that passage in, you know, in the Bible book of Isaiah for the terminology that they're using, like Mount Assembly and things like that, where the residence of that Faithful of Days is. And so in that same context, because that's also being used to illuminate the rebellion, that's where they're getting, you know, immediately before that passage is where they're getting the name Lucifer, and, you know, associating it with a celestial being like they're doing. And so they were talking quite a bit, you know, just as much in terms of paragraphs in that section about the rebellion and the consequences to the order of things in our constellation. And that very last little paragraph in section 4 was segueing into this section. So let me read that again. So just that last little paragraph that's, you know, all right, right there before section 5. And I'll point out the segue again. All right, so since the Lucifer Rebellion, a new structure has been provided near the residence of the Faithful of Days. This temporary edifice is the headquarters of the Most High Liaison. That's who we're going to read about tonight. Who functions in close touch with the Paradise Sun, the Faithful of Days, as advisor to the constellation government in all matters respecting the policy and attitude of the Order of Days towards sin and rebellion. All right, so they're about to point out, you see, we start out this next section with this long list of 12 different Verondadex sons. And one of them, as they're saying, they're going to call the Most High Liaison. He's the one that's going to be the interface between the actual constellation government and this advisor. So, you know, just... then that's an exceptional thing. Normally, just having the Faithful of Days there, and every once in a blue moon, the Most Highs interact with that individual and get what they need in terms of advice. But in the wake of the two facts that give rise to the exceptional naming that they select for our constellation, the fact they don't just call it Norlasha, they call it Norlasha Dec, that they stick that Dec suffix on, remember, as we pointed out, it's because we have these two special colleges, two special schools on our constellation headquarters, on Adentia, to deal with two great big piles of problems that have come to pass in this constellation. One of them in the wake of the Lucifer Rebellion, the other in the wake of Michael selecting a world in this constellation for his seventh bestowal. And so all, you know, the whole order of things gets thrown into turmoil. Everything has to readjust to both of those, you know, very significant you know, giant rocks thrown into the pond of this constellation. And you'll see as we get into this list of 12. Instead of just having the normal three, we've got this whole group of 12 veranda decks that are leading. You need all of this additional help because, apparently there's just nonstop, practically, interaction that's required between the actual Constellation Administrators and the Faithful of Days. So that you've got a veranda deck that's, his sole job is just to try to keep up, and be the conduit for all of this interaction that's required. They're not going to give us any great clues about what all these veranda decks are up to, specifically. Again, mostly because the problems, quote unquote, that they're dealing with are beyond our comprehension. I'm sure almost totally, because everything that's going on beyond our mortal sphere is pretty much beyond our comprehension, as they tell us so many times. Even the day-to-day, trivial issues on the First Mansion world are really beyond our comprehension of how the economy of that all, that whole process. But we can, they obviously are giving us all these in little, little paragraphs, bullet points about each, because they want us to speculate a little bit, try to reflect on just how real, if you will, things are on high. There are all kinds of issues in the universe of universes. It isn't some sort of innately perfect domain, and everything just floats on the cloud and no one ever has to do anything to keep it all running smoothly. People are scrambling in countless numbers all the time trying to keep this whole complex system running smoothly. All right, so let's get into it here.
Section 5, the Audientia Fathers since the Lucifer Rebellion. The rotation of the Most Highs on Audientia was suspended at the time of the Lucifer Rebellion. We now have the same rulers who were on duty at that time. We infer that no change in these rulers will be made until Lucifer and his associates are finally disposed of.
So just again, remember, because they mentioned to you, 50,000, approximately 50,000 Earth years is their normal cycle for the three of them, the Constellation Father, the Senior Most High, and the Junior Most High. They rotate through them. They get a new Junior Most High, and the other two bump up a notch in the hierarchy, and they just keep cycling through every 50,000 of our years. This is a long, past, 200,000 years ago for, that rotation to have occurred. Who knows how far they were into their, they're the one they were in when the rebellion occurred, but...
wording disposed of mm-hmm. is not adjudicated, disposed. So it's sort of preordained that they're going to get the axe, or he's going
to
get the axe.
Well, remember the core individuals have gone all the way to iniquity.
Okay, so I'm just waiting for the axe.
Remember how they tell you that no one sees anything... that's intriguing anymore, no one pays him a visit anymore, that means, there's no longer any positive luminosity to experience there, and perhaps the wonder is like, well, maybe there, there's still hope for him, we shouldn't give up, is not mercy unlimited? For a long time, there were many voices like that in the cosmos where, these people were being, given lots and lots of opportunity to not be hopeless by their fellow celestial beings. They weren't writing them off. They've learned from God's mercy ministry. They know what links... everyone goes to make sure that there's no presumption about anything. So remember last time we were reading about how for a long time people were allowing Satan and or Lucifer to come up to the conclaves. And finally that came to an end when all of them unanimously recognized, no. But before that, see, obviously at least one of those was saying, no, I think we should give them a chance, So they were still being given a seat because at least one person, wanted to keep the door open. So, but things, the doors have been closing and closing and closing. It started to close pretty definitively around the beginning of the 20th century when they rounded up Satan and turned him. Obviously, that's a sign that things are, are starting to move along, like they tell you in the book, that, the adjudication is getting going. But how long it'll take to finish, who knows? And back to your immediate point, I mean, it's not just quote-unquote adjudicating the situation, but those who get the thumbs down in the adjudication, then are obliterated by the executioner, the Ancient of Days, or the executioners of the Ancients of Days. So disposed of, the energy system is turned back into raw materials, and that's the, the disposition process that they're speaking of there. Okay, we kind of have that in play all the time, and when we talk about the rebellion, keep that kind of that basic background, those background facts in mind whenever you think about the rebellion, what's going on with that whole long drawn out adjudication process. But let's get back to the to the Constellation headquarters here, and let's look at this list. So maybe read the preface in 1, 2, and 3 there, and then we'll talk.
The present government of the Constellation, however, has been expanded to include 12 sons of the Virondedec order. These 12 are as follows. 1. The Constellation Father, the present Most High Ruler of Nerlashadec, is number 617,318 of the Virondedec series of Nebadon. He saw service in many constellations throughout our local universe before taking up his Edentia responsibilities. 2. The Senior Most High Associate. 3. The Junior Most High Associate.
Okay, so there's our 3 that are still going on. And obviously, in the big picture, it's only 50,000 of our years. Or 150,000 total, they go through junior, senior, and then be Constellation Father. Things have been around for a very long time in the universe of Nebadon, so obviously a Virondedec, will have seen lots and lots and lots of service, in many different constellations, like they're saying. Just keep that in mind when you compare 200 billion years, when you had the first inhabited worlds in the local universe of Nebadon to 50,000 years, that's a pretty big difference. So, they're in the span of that, they're just serving a relatively short time. Yep.
Winston's asking, so if people on Earth want to give hope to our defaulted prince, then we too will see adjudication of this fallen individual?
Being stretched out, right? I mean, remember they tell you about that. I mean, we've hardly begun to work through the actual human choosing of rebellion, you want to join the rebellion or not. We're just now of a sophisticated enough mind to actually begin to contemplate the rebellion in its actual nature, not some silly fairy tale, but the actual philosophic war that is the rebellion. I mean, humans have to be capable of philosophic consciousness of some rudimentary nature in order to really engage that positively or negatively. Some sort of like I said, fairy tale thing involving anthropomorphic material notions or some goofy spiritual concepts that really aren't spiritual in any way at all, except in name, right? I mean, that doesn't get you, in or out of the rebellion. I mean, you've got to be genuinely falling victim to the philosophic sophistries or not. We've just entered the time of this testing. That's part of why the revelation is here. It's here to help with that philosophic discrimination. You can attune to the rebellion that so many people are unwittingly doing right now for over 100 years, pretty aggressively. Or you can recognize the truth that the revelation is trying to help you to recognize. And Creative Mother Spirit instructed her angels to catalyze this bifurcation of mankind as much as she can. She wants to get those who are going to go to iniquity going to iniquity as fast as possible, and those that are not, going to a definitive consecration to eternity as quickly as possible, and let's get this out of our system and let's move on. She's not just saying that about our world. There's 37 rebellion spheres. And this has got to get worked out on all of them, sooner the better, in terms of, what Michael and Creative Mother Spirit are thinking. So, that whole issue of quote unquote sympathy for the devil, especially when you, when you use the term devil to apply to the planetary prince rather than Satan or Lucifer, it's very apropos. How much sympathy for Kalagastia is there? He spins a very seductive spiritual argument. He's looking for spiritually conscious people who are philosophically ignorant. Does that describe you? If so, note the word danger in the Urantia book occasionally. Right? Simplistic, very materially minded person isn't capable of getting into the rebellion. They're just matter of fact, they're going to go through life just fine. Doesn't matter how ignorant they are or whatnot, they'll go through just fine. But someone who's starting to wake up a little bit, you're waking up to the choice. That spiritual spark is sparking you into a choice. And it's very stark. Eternity or oblivion. Choose.
John has a question.
Let's go ahead here first.
I was just going to ask Chris, or make a comment and ask you, the Mother Spirit accelerating this process doesn't mean she's disallowing choice.
No.
It's just accelerating the rate of choice. The choices are still there in front of each individual.
Right.
It's just accelerating the opportunity for choice.
Right. And technically how she's doing that is not in a positive mode and a negative mode. She's making sure that if you really want to choose sin, that someone isn't unfortunately thwarting your opportunity to choose sin. Wants to make sure that, you have an unlimited opportunity for sin expression, quote unquote. Right? So just think about, we've talked about that many times. Someone is trying to go out into the world, as a movement, trying to get in, insert themselves into situations and help people to not make those sinful choices that they're making. It's like, well, guess what? You may actually get thwarted in your efforts with your nonprofit organization or whatever by the angels. Right? We have to recognize that's going on. That's a very, definitive thing. And so, if your idealistic consciousness wonders why, with all of this idealistic awareness on the world, why isn't there more effect to this? Why aren't we improving the situation more? Well, it may be because we're being literally thwarted in those efforts by the angels, because we're going to make it so there isn't unlimited opportunity for sin expression if we're successful in that regard right now. So, you know, just something to consider. Obviously, it doesn't prove you may fail just because you're inept, right? Completely idealistically hopeless, you know, and can't think pragmatically enough to actually be effective. That may be why you failed.
Do the angels a favor once.
But it also could be because you were thwarted, you know, that they threw a monkey wrench in your works. Okay, then over here.
Quickly, the other, okay, obviously the Urantia book is primary for our development philosophically, etc., to make the proper choices to thwart iniquity. What about the other 36 and 37 planets that are in the rebellion? Do they need a revelation?
Again, you know, I can't know this. Well, I mean, and so for those of you on the webinar, he's asking about what about the other 36 planets in terms of what they might need to, you know, help them overcome the rebellion. My initial comment is, well, I mean, obviously, I can't say much in definitive. The only thing I have any data points about is the neighboring planet, and you know, what little hint at the end of the government on a neighboring planet paper, you know, do we have? You know, simply that, you know, they're looking forward to a magisterial sun showing up, right, in the very near term. You know, and so, you know, you look between the lines, that would seem to be suggesting that, you know, rather than a book or something like that, you know, that's probably the basic plan there, you know, is before things go totally out the window, you know, to have a magisterial son step in, you know, and that's a distinct probability there. You know, at the time they wrote the book, the island continent was doing fairly well, but of course since that time, they've developed the same kind of technology that we have. You know, they're running very close to us, you know, in terms of technological development. So they've developed nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missiles and stuff since the book was written. You know, the island continent is not so isolated anymore. Things are, and then just to make matters worse, there's starting to be some religious zealotry, you know, springing up on the island continent. So they're threatening to be, you know, assaulted from without like they could never be assaulted before, and they're threatening to be torn apart from within by the sixth adjutant, you know, by that religious impulse like they've never been torn apart before. It would be pretty handy. See, and that's why they're so like, boy, we sure do hope that in the not too distant future, I mean, that's why they're so, you know, you can just read between the lines at the end of that paper how they're really, really hoping, because they can see the writing on the wall. Well, things are starting to get very interesting there. Yeah. And then what are the other planets, you know? Who knows?
Two questions.
Yep.
First one, what is the difference between a philosophical argument and a spiritual one in this case?
Well, we don't want to get too far afield here, but just remember that it's not, I mean, fundamentally, it's not a distinction between goodness and ungoodness that is in front of you. That's not the challenge fundamentally that's in front of you, being able to distinguish between goodness and badness and picking properly. It's subtler than that. It's transcendent of that. It's the ability to distinguish between truth and falsehood, truth and untruth. You know, and that involves, you know, the super additive consequence of the relationship between fact and goodness is truth. If you're very biased to your spiritual consciousness, your unity consciousness side, and have a very poor track record of distinguishing fact from figment, or being able to really think logically about individuality, you know, that's, like I said, that's exactly who the rebels are looking for. Because there's no way you have any relationship to truth. You know, if you don't have a relationship with fact, doesn't matter how much relationship to goodness you have, you don't have a relationship to truth. You know, and you're gonna, he can take a big glob of falsehood, paint it with goodness paint, you know, wrap it in spiritual candy, like I always say. Hand it to you, and you'll swallow it. You know, as you know, oh, look how beautiful this is, how good this is. Yeah, but what's inside of it? Who cares? Look how beautiful it is. You know, that's why all the angels fell and whatnot, because they didn't have the insight, you know, to be able to penetrate through the spiritual candy that he was doling out. It was oh so brilliant and seductive. You know, and they fell for the falsehood. You know, that's the difference. You know, a lot of people give lip service to truth, but the revelation is here, and the more you study it, the more you recognize, I don't have any idea what truth is, do I? Okay? I've been using that word a lot, but I'm clueless. It's obviously something way beyond anything I've ever really imagined before. The spirit of truth has been twiddling its thumbs with me all my life. Nothing yet to do. I need to take delight in cultivating, being more than just having more than just the ability to see goodness, you know, and grab a hold of it indiscriminately. Right? You know, you have to use those three cosmic intuitions that allow you to discriminate. Right? Have you been taught? You know, remember about the end of paper 34 about the mistaught? Have you been taught the word discrimination or discriminate is a fundamentally bad word, should never be contemplated or used? Have you been taught that? That's what's taught on the planet today in many circles. If so, you've been taught to move as far away from the Holy Spirit as possible. You didn't know you were being taught that, but that's what you're being taught. You've been taught to move away from the discriminator, the Holy Spirit. And it's sad to record that you can't, you have no ability then. You know, if you've moved as far away from the Spirit, from the Holy Spirit as possible, you know, you're even farther away from the Spirit of Truth or some help from your adjuster or something. You know, the relationship to the Holy Spirit is your means to get to the adjuster or the Spirit of Truth. So you're just the kind of person that the rebels are looking for. Someone who's not sophistry-proof. Someone that will fall for any spiritual candy that's thrown at them. Right? Just like the benighted individuals that spike Halloween, you know, candies, you know, little kids. That's the way those rebels function. They make something as seductive as they can, and they put it in front of your face. Yep, another question?
Well, let me, before this question, I want to say something.
Mm-hmm.
When you say discriminate, you're not saying discrimination. And when you say discriminate, I think you might mean to sort, to be paying attention to the details. And taking time to have insight and noticing, what it is and putting in that work.
Well, I mean, technically, I do mean, you know, discriminate and discrimination are the same word. I mean the core meaning of the word, not that tangential meaning that humans have, you know, focused on, you know, where they see it as a negative word. That's not the real meaning of the word. The real meaning of the word is purely positive. We've twisted it around and, you know, turned it into a negative word. It's not a negative word, not at all, not one iota in its core nature. That's why the revelers want you to rediscover that, you know, the core meaning of that word. You have to go beyond mere distinguishing between two facts. You need to discriminate, which means you have to have the ability to discern subtle differences. A mere difference is one thing, but a subtle difference, to distinguish that, is to discriminate. That's what the word discriminate means. It means you have the ability to see the subtleties. You can see those subtleties because of the Holy Spirit gift. Without the Holy Spirit gift, you can't see those subtleties. Our vision is too coarse. Right? And so you can't, they look identical to you. But if you open the eyes of cosmic insight, they look completely different. If you look at them objectively, they look completely different. You can discriminate between the two of them. If you look at them subjectively, they're identical. Right? That's why all those celestial beings are falling for this. They don't have enough objective insight to discriminate between the two facts that are being put in front of him. What Gabriel puts forward and what Lucifer puts forward. And, they look the same in kind of substance, but then Lucifer sweetens the deal and he wraps his fancy bow around his. And you go, well, they're identical. Why not take the one with the bow? Right? That's how he does it. Right? Now, and if you can't tell, that one of them is black and one of them is white, if they both look white to you, and the only difference is the bow, then you take the one with the bow.
So the cat food commercial with the cat with a discriminating taste is more accurate use of the word.
Yeah, just reflect on. I mean, if you look in a good dictionary, you'll see what the word discriminate actually means.
It promotes a deeper consciousness, right. More depth of consciousness.
Right, it requires depth of consciousness to discriminate. Yeah. See, and to turn around and make it seem like that word implies you have no depth of consciousness. See how just that sees a sophistry. That's the Lucifer rebellion playing out on the planet in the language. That he's gotten that word turned all the way around in our minds. That's his effort. Right? Instead of it being deep, it's shallow. Right? Yeah. Right. It's that whole, thing that so many people, so many linguists and stuff bemoan about what's been going on for decades. All these words are getting completely corrupted. Yeah, why?
And then the other question, when does the thwarting stop? It would seem to be self-perpetuating generation after generation unless it is finally thwarted once and for all.
Eventually this will all... I mean, on Gerasim, where everyone had a reasonable intellect in play, unlike here, you went through the process in just 2 years. So, once the vision is there, we can work through this in fairly short order. I mean, if anything, see, the Spirit of Truth is a catalyzer, and the adjuster too, to sorting through it all the faster once we get our eyes open. But see, step one is getting our eyes open. We've just gotten to the point where we're opening our eyes enough to be able to have the option in play.
What I don't understand is why would they give Lucifer such time, and then you said the Mother Spirit's trying to put everybody to sin, as much as they're going to sin.
Well, not trying to make them sin. Just
allow them to sin.
Right, allowing them to sin if they want to.
We are here just animal origin beings. We're stupid people. Mm-hmm. Why would they not give us mercy like they're given this high being?
They've given you more mercy than they've given the other 36 planets.
What was the question?
Right? See, the question is why would they allow, Lucifer to go on this? Why isn't there the infinite mercy that I've heard about? There is. Every hopeless, ignorant person on this planet gets a thought adjuster by grace now, gets a soul by grace, wakes up in the first mansion world by grace. Think about one of those other, think about the neighboring planet. Okay, they got almost no biologic uplift, just like us, because, if your planetary prince falls, it's basically a given, the Adam and Eve are not going to make it. Right, so they didn't get the biologic uplift like they were supposed to. So they've got these ignorant, blobs of protoplasm between their ears, just like us. And, but do they have the universal bestowal of thought adjusters and the Spirit of Truth? No. They've got countless innocent people on the planet with no soul. No, you know, they're too ignorant, and it's, the situation is too hopeless for them to have any chance of getting up to being a third circler. I mean, you got to hope that, you know, some of them are, you know, going to become spirit fusers, you know, especially through the really mysterious process where the Supreme steps in. But in and of their own, there's going to be an awful lot of them that won't get an adjuster. So they won't, you know, there is no future for them. Right? These are the, you know...
except in the Supreme.
Right, you know, except for the, you know... Right, but just, you know, if... Now, if it wasn't significant for a bestowal son to come and get the universal bestowals out of gestures, it would never happen. You know, if the Supreme just always took care of it. No, there's a lot of people that will not get a soul on those other worlds. You know, the wages of sin are death. You know, and there's an awful lot of blobs of protoplasm that are never going to get an opportunity to actually become an ascending son of God. They're just going to be disposed of, quote unquote. I mean, that, you know, our raw material is going to be recycled, you know.
Before reaching the first mansion.
Right, they're not going to get to the first mansion world. Just like before 2,000 years ago, lots and lots of people
they're
on this planet.
They're not necessarily sinning, they're unconsciously.
Right,
they're
committing evil. Right, they're not. I mean, they're just, you know, they're not getting up to the point where they can get an adjuster, so they don't go on. Right, yep.
I thought once you have the seventh adjutant,
mm-hmm.
and you get enveloped in the Holy Spirit, you get your personality at that point.
Right, personality engages,
so
right?
You keep calling them people, but right. They're really not.
No, they're persons.
They have personality.
Yeah, they have personality, and they're encircled in the Holy Spirit. They don't have a soul.
Right? They have will, but they don't have...
Right. The only way you can have a soul is if you get an adjuster. Right? We can't make a soul. Only an adjuster can make a soul for us. That's the whole point. The prerequisites of adjuster indwelling. You know, up there in paper 108, right? That's what that's all about. See, and all of that... See, none of us have to worry about that anymore. Now we all get an adjuster. So all those things that they used to teach, all the things that the revelators used to teach us before Pentecost, you know, all the prophets and teachers on this planet for millennia, you know, trying to get us to recognize, yeah, you need to get a hold of this. I mean, you've got to get up to the point where you get an adjuster, or you're not going to have a soul, you're not going to survive. You know, the kind of things they taught were had a lot of fear to them. Right? Because there was a serious issue in play. If you didn't get an adjuster, that was the end of it. Right? So they were, you know, they were running around with big signs saying, you know, repent for, you know.
That makes sense.
But none of that's in play anymore. Now you can just be completely clueless and hopeless, and you get an adjuster and a soul by grace, and you wake up in the first mansion world.
Are there people on this planet with no souls?
No. Basically not. I mean, you know, there's always the possibility for subhuman individuals, but setting the subhumans aside, I mean, even if you're extremely primitive, if you're genuinely human, you get an adjuster, you have a soul, you wake up in the first mansion world. Right? And not only that, you don't have to, you even get at least an advanced adjuster. Right? Instead of a virgin adjuster. Right? So, you know, some poor primitive, you know, person in the middle of New Guinea, you know, that just stopped using stone tools, you know, a couple weeks ago. Literally, you know,
Amazon.
Literally, right? You know, it doesn't matter. They get an adjuster and have a soul, and they don't have to work their way up to some sort of a cosmic recognition, you know, get up to a third circle or something like this where they get an adjuster.
So you're saying then that because we have the thought adjuster, that's the mercy that was given to us.
Well, and technically it's the spirit of truth. The thought adjuster is a consequence, you know.
Spirit of truth.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's why that if we became iniquitous, let's say, we would not have the mercy that that Lucifer is getting, because we have the thought adjuster, which he never had, and that's why they would give him more of a chance than us, because if we go to iniquity, we're annihilated. Is that what you're saying?
Well, okay. I know the people in the webinar can't hear. Just that whole point of you're correct. Lucifer doesn't have a thought adjuster. There is infinite mercy. Of him whom much has not been given, much can't be expected. Right? I mean, you know, the flip side, in the long run, I mean, not in this life, this short life, but in the long run, you've been given an adjuster. Okay? A lot is expected of you now. Right? You know, that whole bit about infinite mercy, it's like, well, an awful lot of that is all embodied right there in your adjuster. I mean, what more do you want? You have a fragment of infinity. That's a fairly significant gift. And then on top of that, you know, talking about us going to iniquity, I mean, the more these gifts we're given, the harder it is for us to go to iniquity. I mean, I have to... Now, I don't just have to overrule one spirit ministry, I have to overrule three. I have to overrule all the ministry of my adjuster, I have to overrule all the ministry of the Spirit of Truth, all the ministry of the Holy Spirit. I've got this full-on assault I have to make to all of these incredible gifts of grace, I mean, in order to get to iniquity. Talk about swimming upstream to try to get to iniquity now, right? I mean, if you get to iniquity, you are really, really clueless now. I mean, it is indeed sad to record if you make it to iniquity now with all this help. So, you know, and then on top of it, you know, by grace of the default, we don't live very long in our ignorance. We wake up in the first mansion world with all kinds of angelic helpers and whatnot. And then it's even more pitiful if you go to iniquity, right? You've got 100 million helpers who are radiant and beautiful all around you. You've got to reject all of them. You've got to reject the Spirit of Truth, your thought adjuster, the Holy Spirit. You've got to reject all of that. You can literally feel those spirit ministries when you have a Marantia mind. They aren't just these abstract things that we talk about now. You know, you can literally feel them. You have to grab a hold of them and shove them out of your mind. Anyway. Okay, let's get back to this. Okay, so one other little thing. I thought it was just going to be a tiny little pause. In item number one there, just a little trivia question. Since they seem to be kind of tossing something like that out, when they say that this Veranda deck is number 617,318, just your first little contextualization of that statement, you know, you don't know what to do with it specifically, but how many Veranda decks are there in Nevadon? Does anyone remember?
It's millions.
A million. Right. So, he's kind of towards the end of that group of a million. For what that means, I have no idea. But anyway, just that initial point of context for that. He's 617,000 out of a million. All right, let's take a look at this next one.
Four, the Most High Advisor, the personal representative of Michael since his attainment of the status of a master son.
Okay, I mean, it's all just straightforward, but just, let it sink in. Oh, so number four hasn't been here, been in play very long, right? Just 2,000 years. And it's easy to kind of forget that when they talk about something. I mean, 2,000 years relative to billions of years in Nerlashadek. Okay, I mean... we've got 12 of them here, but obviously, until very recently, there was at least only 11. Okay, so So that's another thing about, you know, you think, oh, there's 12 of them, and that's kind of some sort of special number. But notice it, like, it wasn't just 12 all right away. It slowly evolved into 12. And so, you know, if you were to reflect on what the significance of them being 12 is, there's all this. Coincidentally, there was also the Stole world for Michael in this constellation, and because of that, you added a few more Veronidecs, and it ended up being 12 then in total. And you notice they're obviously hinting at some sort of pattern that we don't totally appreciate, because this one, is he number 11, say? No, he's number 4 in the list, and yet he's very recent. So they're not just adding him on the end numerically. I see there's some, they are hinting, see, with that sort of stuff, that there's some pattern to be recognized there. How this 12-foldness matches up with the 12-fold pattern in the central universe, and why the Most High Advisor is number 4 and not number 7 or number 12 or whatever. Right? I obviously don't claim to have figured all that out, but yeah, it's just none of this is a coincidence, and it's a great example of how you have sort of the fiat sort of actions of those who come down from existential deity doing things, combined with, you know, what experiential deity does, and the two come together and complete a pattern. You know, some of it's involved in this 12, the other is involved in the rest of the 12, and yeah, so just appreciate, you know, how interesting this whole system is, that there are no coincidences, and some sort of an interesting pattern got completed here, that now there can be 12 of these. And I'm sure those on high are fascinated by this too. It's like, well, you look at that, you know, and when you figure out, well, we need one for this, and we need one for this, and one for this, you know, they just sort of deal with it pragmatically, and they list them all, and they go, wait a minute, that's the 12-fold pattern, that one's like that, and that one's like, isn't that amazing? You know, they would notice the same thing. Oh, this just, there's no escaping this universal influence of pattern and how it all comes together. Okay, so you've got this individual that's, you know, sort of like the deputy of Michael. The things that Michael wants to happen in this constellation that are different because it's his bestowal constellation. This Most High Advisor is serving to be the voice and the intermediary for that issue. All right, what about the next one?
5. The Most High Executive, the personal representative of Gabriel, stationed on Edentia ever since the Lucifer Rebellion.
Okay, so just the parallel one, see? Now they're going, oh, now we've got a pair. One for Gabriel, one for Michael. One tied to the bestowal, one tied to the rebellion. Yeah, and we know Gabriel, like I mentioned earlier, was definitely the point person with the rebellion. It wasn't Michael, you know, speaking contrary to Lucifer on Gerasim. It was Gabriel. Okay, so there's that one. And, you know, he's the chief executive, so it's the Most High Executive. You can see the obvious pattern there. All right.
6. The Most High Chief of Planetary Observers, the director of the Veronidec Observers stationed on the isolated worlds of Satania.
And we talk about the Most High Observer. They'll mention it at the end of this section. So each of the 37 has a Most High Observer, each of the isolated worlds, and there is a chief of them all. You know, there's a, in other words, there's an awful lot of logistics to keep on top of what's going on with those 37 observers. There has to be a person whose sole job is to oversee that issue. All right, so what about the next one?
7. The Most High Referee, the Veronidec son entrusted with the duty of adjusting all difficulties consequential to rebellion within the constellation.
Okay, so now that's an interesting one. I mean, you know, there's a number of different ways that they're adjusting to these difficulties. I mean, for instance, that college. And you can imagine this referee interacts a lot with that Melchizedek College and the things they're working on. But to have this single individual through which that specific issue is all flowing through is kind of interesting. And you can see, you know, definitely that fundamental nature of the Verondadex is having this definitive individual integrity that the Melchizedeks don't have. You know, the Melchizedeks have this, collectively have an integrity, just like the Verondadex collectively do. But remember how the difference is, the Melchizedeks don't have an individual integrity like a Verondadek does. And so these Verondadeks can, you know, there's just one Verondadek, and all of that complexity is feeding through him. Yeah, very, quite the responsibility. You know, so everything is getting referred to him. He's the referee. You know, and you see, you know, how they're stressing what I was just saying, entrusted, right? The Verondadeks as individuals can be trusted like a Melchizedek can't.
What did you say Verondadek meant again?
Very father-like expression. You know, the D-A is, you know, da, father. Vor is very, so these very father-like expressions have this definitive individual integrity. You know, that father-like individuality of the part, or is the mother's individuality of the whole? You know, so there's an integrity in the wholeness of a group of Melchizedeks, you know, or a group of Verondadeks. But see, there's also more of this. See, they're very father-like, so they have more of that individuality of the part integrity that is tied to the father. Like the father relates to you just as an individual. He doesn't relate to us as a group. He doesn't relate to the group of people in this room. He relates to me as an individual, you as an individual, and it's just a, you know, an issue that he has no relationship to, that we happen to be in the same room talking to each other at the same time. It relates to each of us individually, the individuality of the parts. All right, so so there's that guy. How about the next one here?
8, the Most High Emergency Administrator. The Verondadek son charged with the task of adapting the emergency enactments of the Nerleshadek legislature to the rebellion-isolated worlds of Satania.
Okay, see, so now that's an interesting one. That gives you a little hint about, if you're wondering, like, well, they mentioned that they're passing these laws in the legislature on Adentia that relate to the rebellion. And you know, you might wonder, well, is it like it always is, where, you know, they're passing a law for the whole constellation? Or are they getting down into the details? You know, are they passing a law just for that isolated world or something like that? No, apparently not, see. They're passing a law, they're still passing laws that govern the whole constellation, but there's a special Verondadek whose job it is to downstep that generality into the specificity of each world. And so that's kind of a, you know, another little interesting insight into the you know, how they're handling this, the hierarchy. And it reminds you, you know, like they will again with the Verondadek observers, the Verondadeks have very much inserted themselves into details that they normally don't insert themselves into. Normally, the details are handled by the local system, the non-index and all their associates and stuff are handling all the micro details. And the Verondadek are above all that. No, they very much have gotten themselves down in the details. They're literally, you know, doing things related to a single individual on a single world, stuff like this. You know, Verondadek observer, I want, you know, you to, you know, have such and so action relative to that individual. I mean, they're getting down into the details in the trenches like they normally don't do.
Yeah. Chris, it just occurred to me, mm-hmm. is this some of the stuff that when they say Daniel knew all these things about the Most
Right.
High,
yes.
that he knew about it?
Right, see, yeah.
He knew the specifics of this, and that's why he could prophesy like he did specifically that this kingdom and this ruler would be overthrown and then this right. one would take his place.
Right, because he's interacting with the Most High Observer. Yeah. See, that's the thing. I mean, there's only way to understand that statement, like I said back there, is that he's a cosmic reservist. He's not just, you know, some ignorant destiny reservist. He's got to be a cosmic reservist. I mean, he fully understood these things. I mean, you know, he knows all about all this stuff. And I was going to, you know, they're going to mention that down at the bottom of this section. You see it, they remind you of that just so you think about that very issue. All right, yep. All right, let's see, anything else there? So let's see, then. You've got these, this individual that's handling, you know, rather than stuff being coming up through a lot of threads and feeding through him, you know, he's got one thread coming in and he's breaking it up into a whole bunch of specific threads that are going to each of those worlds. All right.
9, the Most High Mediator, the Virandadek Son assigned to harmonize the special bestowal adjustments on Urantia with the routine administration of the constellation. The presence of certain archangel activities and numerous other irregular ministrations on Urantia, together with the special activities of the brilliant evening stars on Gerasim, necessitates the functioning of this sun.
Okay, so there's another one that's only been in play for a very short period of time. You know, and it's kind of interesting, the whole bit of, especially in Christianity, where Jesus becomes a substitute for Mithras, you know, who is the mediator. You know, and so there's all those ideas of Jesus as the mediator in Christianity. You see, related to him becoming a master son, you know, there's a Most High Mediator, which is kind of an interesting little sidelight. So here's another one. It's just, you know, for the last 2,000 years, and you know, he's not number 12. He's number 9 again. You're left to wonder why he fits into the pattern there, just that specific point of all the adjustments that have to be made, and you're going, well, what kind of adjustments? You know, they at least can give you a couple little hints about. Well, it's like, remember, some of the things that are normally on Salvington have been moved off. Some of them are now on Gerasim, and some of them are on your planet. I mean, normally, that archangel stuff is on Salvington. It's on this ball of dirt here for some reason, and even the revelators don't understand what that's about. It basically means that effectively, this is we're standing on a chunk of Salvington here. Right? Have you ever worried that maybe Salvington would be destroyed and won't be part of eternity?
No.
No. So why are you worrying that this planet might be destroyed and won't be part of eternity? For 2,000 years, it's effectively been part of Salvington. Right? The archangels don't set up a divisional headquarters, you know, on a pile of fluff. Right? Right. I mean, it's just a little reminder of how consequential this is. And so, you know, you just think about all that, and they don't even understand all this. They're not even being told all the future plans that Michael has. And so they're trying to anticipate. It's like, well, you know, if he decides to go that way, well, we better have this stuff set up so that if that order comes down, we can, right? They're trying to, you know, be as ready as possible for all the possible things that this might be foreshadowing. And brilliant evening stars have a lot to do with light and light destiny of local universes and stuff. I mean, so this, it's huge stuff. See the implications of this, that he's bringing into play the end closer to the beginning with some of these acts, and they don't, you know, they're trying to figure out what's going on with all that.
Do you think it would necessarily have to be date from Michael's pistol, or could have been perhaps dated maybe from the time Melchizedek was here?
Well, remember, the archangel circuit first functioned, for the dispensational resurrection following Jesus and stuff. I mean, this stuff is all put into play. You know, all these various things that he put into place at Pentecost. Now, what we know is Pentecost. You know, the 24 counselors and all these sorts of things. You know, all that stuff was set up, all this special stuff. Yeah.
I wonder how much, you know, Dean's question relates to the idea of what kind of anticipation on the part of Herodotus, who are far-seeing.
Right, for the 40,000 years that they knew this stuff was, you know, and yeah, so, obviously.
And so, the you know, part of that and... you know, it's just interesting to consider when they might have placed themselves in there, especially given the numbering.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is the significance of the numbering?
Right, yeah.
It would have been 9 until 2,000 years ago if they were all, those other 3 were just placed then.
Yeah.
Which is what the implication is if they were only just placed.
Right, yeah.
So how much anticipation is there?
Right. See, again, like I said, all these things are open to speculation. I was just trying to toss out some, you know, things, you know, and it's like, well, you know, I mean, you put forward a hypothesis, you know, and then you try to refute it, and maybe you finally say, well, maybe it isn't just the last 2,000 years, you know. You know, they're just, I just wanted to make sure you recognize that even in the most trivial of things like a list, there's all kinds of questions in play. Nothing is accidental, right? Everything is some sort of a pattern, and you're trying to figure out, is it, how much is it a supremacy where coincidentally they just fall in? How much is actual foresight where you can plan it ahead, you know? Which is it? That's all, you know. All right, so let's see, anything else there?
Chris?
Oh, yep.
Real quick. Mm-hmm. Last week you spoke about the morning star and...
Right.
What is the bright evening?
The brilliant evening star. See, you know, so that's just a, you know, an expression, historically for Venus, right after sunset, just like, you know, bright morning star is Venus, before sunrise, right. And so, like I said last time, they just take those two expressions, and they capitalize the words and are using them for a proper designation. Again, it's not because the things they're calling brilliant evening stars have anything to do with Venus, right? You know, at twilight. I mean, you know, not at all. Remember, they just, you know, they were told, don't coin a new name for any of these beings in English. If you can find some expression that humans have used somewhere that have some relevance, and think about what I just said. I mean, no, they don't literally have to do with evening, as our sun sets on this planet. But what do they have to do with? Remember, like I just said, they have an awful lot to do with a very remote future of things. You know, there's Gabriel, who's there first in the morning, right? The first being in the local universe, right? Beings that have to do with getting things settled and related to transcending the finite and going to absonity, right? Evening. I see they're using these terms to just... You know, they're playing off of, right, they're using them as just masterly. The more you reflect on how they've used these terms, the more you'll just be delighted by what they do.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
There's also a second aspect to that, and that is that it's the brilliant evening stars who serve in the place of Gabriel at all these special commissions. They say, you'll remember, over 1,000 commissions running simultaneously on Salvington at any one time, and they function in his Gabriel's stead.
Right, right. So, is a reason why you want two names that are correlated with each other in some way to remind you of that. Yeah, see, all, you know, just like they do all the of days, you know, to correlate those by their names. Yeah, see, all that stuff is in place. Really clever, you know, what they've done. You know, we were trying to bring that out last time. You know, it's all the clever things they were doing with the Bible passages there. So, you know, to get names for stuff and
Can I ask you one more quick?
Yep.
Quick little thing. Is that brilliant evening star, does that have something to do with, like, what did you say last week, Vespers?
Right. I mean, technically, see, you know, in Latin, the anthropomorphic, you know, personification of Venus in the morning and the evening is Lucifer, for the morning and Vesper for the evening. You know, capital V Vesper is the name for that god, you know, that is Venus after sunset, right? Right, and that's why, you know, evening prayer is Vespers. Okay. All right. Oh, and then, as long as we're talking about brilliant evening stars, you know, remember when young Jesus, it's time you were about your father's business, right? Who has the job of saying that? A brilliant evening star. All right.
10. The Most High Judge Advocate, the head of the emergency tribunal, devoted to the adjustment of the special problems of Narlashadech growing out of the confusion consequent upon the Satania rebellion.
He said, well, wait a minute, wasn't there one already like that? Well, I mean, this is specifically, you know, the judge advocate, okay? You know, the head of the emergency tribunal. So, it's, you know, there's the issues of just the administration, and then there's issues of adjudication. Right. So those are two vast tasks, can't be done by one Veronidect. You know, it's separated. You got one Veronidect's sole job is just to handle all of the court cases that have resulted from this. And they're probably just, you know, innumerable. Right.
What do you think about the numerous other special administrations? To her point about where's our mercy allocation? It's a lot of mercy.
Right. There's just, I mean, the only way to not get to eternity is if you absolutely overrule infinity. Yeah. Right? I mean, the only thing that could overcome infinite grace, which is in place, is something that's absolute. Right? That's what it, you know, means to be absolute. Something is quote unquote absolute in the revelation. You know, that's not some fuzzy term like in the dictionary. It means that that's a fact that can withstand, you know, can stand unmoved in the presence of infinity. It is not deluded by infinity. Something that's supreme or ultimate is deluded by infinity. You know, drop of water into the ocean, it goes. But if something is absolute, it can stand in the intimate presence of infinity and not be washed away. Right? That's why, even though there's infinite grace, that infinite grace doesn't dissolve absolute law. It doesn't wash away absolute law. Absolute law stands unmoved in the presence of infinite grace. It's still there. You know, and it has to be addressed at some point. You know, and same thing with your personality. If all we had was finite and absentite dimensions of our personality, that infinite grace would assure that it would be impossible to choose iniquity. The only way to get to iniquity in the presence of infinite grace is by using the absolute dimension of your personality, because that absolute dimension can withstand infinite grace. It can refuse infinite grace. Right? So again, do you think you've actually exercised your personality in an absolute fashion? You know, someone you point to, well, I think that person went to iniquity. Okay, no, think about it logically. Think about how pitifully primitive and clueless they were. Okay, did they even exercise the finite dimensions of their personality? Really? They probably were just a fancy animal by and large. I mean, they didn't remotely get to the point where they grabbed a hold of their absolute dimension and said, I will not allow infinite grace to touch me. Right, I mean, you have to get to that point. Then and only then are you disposed of.
It's probably the kind of, right? Stuff that Shakespeare struggled with, you know. Yeah. It's probably, you know, some of these advanced.
Like, yeah, I mean, like I've pointed out, you know, don't feel bad that probably most of your life has been fancy animal and not actually personal like you've been wanting to think. That's actually a gift of grace, right? Be thankful that, you know, you weren't immediately able to wield the absolute dimension of your personality in full ignorance. That's a gift of grace. Right? Be thankful that you have parents who didn't hand you a lighter when you were two to play with. Right? Yep.
Is infinity and eternity interchangeable synonyms as opposed to absolute and infinite?
No, infinity, I mean, eternity is related to time. Infinity, in one sense, you can say is related to space, but it's a more general term than that. When I was just using it there, I didn't mean infinite spatial extent. I meant literally lowercase I infinity, which is the totality of reality, an infinite amount of reality, and an absolute nugget can stand in the midst of that and not, you know, become a drop of water in the ocean. I mean, just think about, you know, it's like, well, oh, I could resist that and that and that, but if you bring in too many things, you're eventually going to bring in something that's too big, and I'm going to get lost and be overwhelmed.
That's integrity.
Right? So what it means to be absolute? It means you can bring in everything. Small things, big things, lots and lots of things of everything. Nothing. You stand unmoved in the face of all of it. Right? All right, let's see, right, okay, so you've got this individual who's the judge advocate for the emergency tribunal. All right, the next one.
11, the Most High Liaison. The Verandadex son attached to the Edentia rulers, but commissioned as a special counselor with the Faithful of Days regarding the best course to pursue in the management of problems pertaining to rebellion and creature disloyalty.
Oh, we finally got to him. There he is. So there's the one that they were mentioning at the end of the previous section. Basically, it's just what you were expecting them to say. Not too much for details. But they did throw in a little bit at the end. They didn't just say the management of problems pertaining to rebellion. They threw in that one other little twist at the end there. And creature disloyalty. Like I was saying a little bit ago, we're about to read about the Most High Observer a little bit more, and like we were saying, you know, that whole bit about him making decisions on our observer making decisions on this planet, where he's taking into account, you know, the greatest number of people, you know, for the greatest length of time, and those sorts of generalizations of relationship to us. But that doesn't mean that the Verandadex aren't also involved in details. Okay? That general sort of nature they're talking about, that observer, I mean, that's just bringing the normal generality of the constellation level down to a planet. But they've also, taken the reins of a lot of the individuality details of the local system level. Okay, they aren't just bringing constellation down; they're also, taking over those jobs, and so they're down into individual details too. And they're working through issues of creature disloyalty, a creature's disloyalty, even if it's significant to the big picture. So that's, don't let that what we all so often talk about with the general functioning of the Most High Observer relative to us, let you forget about how they've taken a hold. I mean, we've had Lanaforge in play for a long time, and they still haven't given back a lot of these detail issues to him and his staff. They still hold on to these. Now, many of these details. Did you have something?
Well, you just explained.
Oh, I explained. Okay.
Loyalty
there. Yeah. Okay. You know, and you know that fundamental creature disloyalty, like they mentioned when they talk about the rebellion. You know, that's a very, very consequential thing. If someone knocks the foundation out of their personality, character, by a genuine disloyalty like that, they become a very problematic nugget in the system. There's basically all the king's horses and all king's men can't put that individual back together again. And, you know, they're rattling around in the system. You know, and so they've got to take that into account. Does this individual need to be dealt with, you know, as an individual? Because when we run the projections forward, how that individual interacts with the system is such a negative phenomenon, such a disrupted phenomenon, that's problematic. See, so that's what I'm saying. You know, sometimes, because individuals can be quite consequential to the whole, they have to actually take an individual into account rather than just, you know, who cares about individuals, just, you know, kill them all. Did you have some?
Yeah. You're referring to mortals?
I'm referring to anyone, any individual, and really? Yeah, could be mortals.
High and low.
Yeah, high and low. Yep.
So the primary problem I was thinking of is whether they, you know, discontinue their material life, you know, the creature thing.
I see it again. I mean, you know, everything is possible. If they need to discontinue like I said, you know, they say they remove kings and set up kings. That doesn't necessarily mean that they banish them to the desert for a while. That might mean that Quincy, that guy just isn't living anymore. Right? We're going to read about that at the end of the section here. Sometimes people are going to die. Yeah.
12. The Most High Director, the President of the Emergency Council of Edentia. All personalities assigned to Nerleshadech because of the Satania upheaval constitute the Emergency Council, and their presiding officer is a Verondadek son of extraordinary experience.
Okay, so no details, but apparently there's all kinds of personalities assigned to our constellation that they don't explain. And there has to be a Verondadek that's in charge of all of that. Okay, and then just that little footnote.
And this takes no account of the numerous Verondadeks, envoys of Nebadon constellations, and others who are also resident on Edentia.
So way back when they first introduced Verondadeks in the paper about the local universe suns, you may remember them talking about ambassadors and consuls and right. So they're reminding you of what they said up there, that there's Verondadeks doing all kinds of jobs. And they just want to remind you of that in this context so that you're clear that what they were talking about up there, none of these that we've been reading about, you know, are in that group. These are all exceptional functionings of Verondadeks.
So how do they see us if they're on Edentia? How do they observe here?
There's a Most High Observer
that lives here. Okay.
Yep.
I thought they were.
They have eyes and ears here.
Okay.
Yep. Facebook. See, that's why he's called a Most High Observer. They're not magical. Okay. They have to have one that's here, literally observing and reporting back.
I thought they were up there observing, but they're not. They're right here.
Yeah, the only one that's up there is the one that's in charge of all the ones that are down on the 37 planets. But there's 37 of them that are actually down in the trenches. Yep. Okay, now these last two little things they throw in here.
Ever since the Lucifer Rebellion, the Edentia Fathers have exercised a special care over Urantia and the other isolated worlds of Satania. Long ago, the prophet recognized the controlling hand of the Constellation Fathers in the affairs of nations. When the Most High divided the nations their inheritance, to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the sons of Adam, he set the bounds of the people.
Okay, that quote-unquote prophet is Moses. Okay, and that's in Deuteronomy. And so, what have they just done there? Okay, I mean, the immediacy is all fine and dandy, but think about what's between the lines. They're reminding you that Moses also understood some things, like Daniel did. How did Moses understand some of these things? Right, because Melchizedek taught the Kenites, and that information comes down through the Kenites to Moses. Right, and Moses inserts himself as a leader into the evolutionary stream that's coming down from Abraham. Right, that parallel stream that knows things, because Melchizedek taught them things that he didn't, you know, even remotely try to teach to Abraham. Right, the really important stream is the unknown stream, not the evolutionary stream with Abraham. It's that parallel stream that he set up. Yeah. That knows things, right? Who knows there's a Most High Observer who rules in the kingdoms of men, just like Daniel knew. And, you know, and he was pointing out, he was referring to that. You know, so are they down into details? Yeah, it's like they saw to it that these people lived in this region, these people lived in this region. Right, that's getting into details, right? Like, well, isn't that against my free will? What if I want to live over there? No, it has nothing to do with free will. That's self-assertion, that you want to live somewhere or another. No, they will manipulate your self-assertion and you're going to live over here. They want you to live over here, right? If that's somehow relevant, right?
Is that the observer that does this?
Right, the observer is the one, you know, but he may be getting orders from on high. Those guys on high are interested in all these details. They're keeping track of all the individuals on all those 37 worlds, not important. Oh, okay, we got to keep an eye on this one. This is potentially, you know, a positive or a negative issue. They're in touch with all the details. So, you know, it's a big job. A little reminder, I mean, it takes a huge administration on a local system normally to keep track of all the details on all those, you know, up to 1,000 worlds. And the Veronidex don't normally get into all that, but they're into it all now. Yeah.
Chris, you feel the Kenites were made aware of this kind of detail?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's what they're telling you between the lines. Right? Long ago, the prophet recognized. He didn't just happen to put together a string of words that were useful in this context. No, he recognized the controlling hand of the Constellation Fathers. In the affairs of nations. Right. I mean, obviously, passing down through the generations, you know, it wouldn't necessarily be the latest info or, you know, whatnot, but they had the they understood. Melchizedek told them that they removed kings and set up kings and, you know, they're dealing with these things. So, you know, you're reading in the Bible and it's like, well, yeah, like God, you know, is going to be worrying about that, some trivial detail of the Hebrews. You know, don't be so quick to dismiss that. You know, the Universal Father may not be interested in those details, but the Most High Observer may very well have been interested in that detail.
So that burning bush thing, you know, would that be a high, Most High?
Well, no, there wasn't any burning bush or anything.
But I mean, but it probably was.
But the idea of there being God speaking in a burning bush, okay, I mean, even though that didn't literally happen, where does that come from? I mean, the Melchizedek receivers and the Veronidek observer, they're all interacting with humans. God is talking to humans, interacting with humans, doing things. So, of course, there's stories where, you know, and even if it didn't literally happen in a certain instance, they would talk about it like that because they know about that.
People want to show. They want to put a little spark out of
it. I mean, it's just, that was the world they were living in, a world that where local universe sons were interacting extensively with humans, right? I mean, Ezekiel was literally, you know, being contacted by the author of this paper, right? You know, there aren't any Melchizedeks, you know, contacting us like that today. You don't have those receivers who, you know, they were just trying to keep things going until Jesus got here. And then once Jesus got here, they all left. And that whole regime of that sort of profit making by the Melchizedeks, that's gone. They ended that 2,000 years ago. Right? So people today that think, well, I'm just like one of those Old Testament prophets. No, that isn't in play anymore. Those Melchizedeks are not on the planet anymore. They're not doing that anymore. All right, then the last little thing here.
Every quarantined or isolated world has a Verandadec son acting as an observer. He does not participate in planetary administration except when ordered by the Constellation Father to intervene in the affairs of the nations. Actually, it is the Most High Observer who, quote, rules in the kingdoms of men, unquote. Urantia is one of the isolated worlds of Nerlashadec, and a Verandadec observer has been stationed on the planet ever since the Caligastia betrayal. When Macaventa Melchizedek ministered in semi-material form on Urantia, he paid respectful homage to the Most High Observer then on duty, as it is written, quote, and Melchizedek, king of Salem, was the priest of the Most High, unquote. Melchizedek revealed the relations of this Most High Observer to Abraham when he said, quote, and blessed be the Most High who has delivered your enemies into your hand.
Okay, so those two quotes from Genesis, you know, and that very last one, you know, that's what we refer to so frequently. That's a very, very significant thing that they said. You know that line in Genesis? That's not just a bunch of make-believe. No, that is not just true, but basically fact, verbatim, as it is in the Bible there. Macaventa did not want Abraham to be doing any, this kingdom-building stuff and decimating armies with his army. But the Most High Observer overruled him. The Most High Observer said, no, those armies, they need to be obliterated. And the Most High Observer delivered your enemies into your hand, Abraham's enemies into his hands. You know? Literally. You know, exactly how he did that, you know, again, you can speculate. But one way or another, the Most High Observer made sure that every one of them was dead. Right? Not the warm fuzzy. Yeah, and again, you know, that's a great example, you know, him overruling, you know, the consciousness that we all kind of identify with, you know, of Melchizedek there trying to be a peace promoter. It's like, no, peace promoters sometimes get overruled. I mean, if Melchizedek is a peace promoter can get overruled, how likely is it that a human as a priest peace promoter might get overruled?
Very likely.
Right. If it doesn't fit into the big picture, your peace promoting is going to get overruled, and it's not going to happen. We have to be humble like this and recognize that it may seem like the best thing in our minds, but it may not be at all. It may be the worst thing for there to be peace between Abraham and his people and those other peoples. Instead, they need to be decimated and subjugated. And the Most High Observer made sure that happened. So, again, just a little bit of humility. Don't always think that if peace fails, it's because of Caligastia and his doings and his machinations. It's more likely, since Caligastia can't do anything very literal at all, it's much more likely if there was some sort of intervention that led to that failure of peace, it was all of the good guys. Right? in the Most High Observer, or the angels under the order of the Creative Mother Spirit, or, I mean, that's more, much more likely. I mean, because those individuals can order beings who actually can do material things to do material things if they need to. Kaligashya can't order any material being to do anything. Right? A Most High Observer could order the Master Physical Controllers to do something. You want to talk about doing something physical. Right? And so, just, you know, that's a very different picture of God's watch care than history has sort of taught us. That's a lot more like that volcano god thing in the Old Testament. God the Almighty. Right? There's a truth to that. There's a truth to the God of love, yes. There's also a truth to God the Almighty. Right? That's not just the tailings of the volcano god. So just, you know, keep that in your worldview as you try to rationalize your experiences or the doings on the planet. You know, don't fall into that that Zoroastrian mode all the time, where everything is this, you know, battle between good and evil in a simplistic fashion. Right? There isn't a battle between good and evil in the kingdoms of men. The Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men, period. Kaligashya doesn't rule in the kingdoms of men.
They allow all that evil stuff to happen right now.
They allow it, at least, and sometimes they might actually be promoting it, or literally doing it.
I don't understand.
You know, but it's not evil then, see. See, we're mislabeling it. It looks like evil to us, but it's not.
Big picture.
It can't be evil if the Most Highs are doing it. That means they would be in rebellion. They're not in rebellion. Right? It's just like the greatest affliction is to never have been afflicted. When we're afflicted, we think that's evil. What does the Revelation say? It says, no, the greatest affliction, the worst evil is to never be afflicted. To never be afflicted, now that's evil. That will cut you off from unity like nothing else. Right? That's very different than the story we've all been taught. We've all been mistaught. It's not the way the world works. Where everything that feels prickly is the work of the devil or something, or God's disinterest.
Some things are, though. Some things are, you know.
Some things are the ramifications of the Lucifer Rebellion, yes. But they're not the active machinations of Kaligashya.
Some of them are misunderstood in the big picture.
Yeah. You got something?
It's interesting that maybe what is initiated by Lucifer, the rebellion, is more this philosophical stuff and the philosophical stream of discussion.
Right.
But meanwhile, what happens physically is being moved by the Most Highs and the higher ups. And so things stay together despite all the rebellious talk you hear amongst the talking heads, you know, and things like that.
Right. Again, yeah, just that basic idea that we always have the devil involved in material things.
Yeah.
No. I mean, not only is he basically not interested in such things, he has no ability to engage material things. Yeah. All right. Let's change the environment here a little bit. I think it's time for some beautiful botanic splendor. in the midst of all this discussion of sin and iniquity and rebellion and darkness, and okay, let's read the Gardens of God. Let's go here.
Section 6: The Gardens of God. The system capitals are particularly beautiful, beautified with material and mineral constructions. Well, the universe headquarters are more reflective of spiritual glory. But the capitals of the constellations are the acme of Marantia activities and living embellishments. On the constellation headquarters worlds, living embellishment is more generally utilized, and it is this preponderance of life, botanic artistry, that causes these worlds to be called the gardens of God.
Okay, so they just took that that expression from the Bible, the garden of God, they threw an S in, you know, and put it in the context, there's more than one constellation headquarters. So just a simple little tweaking, just like they do with the, you know, is it kingdoms or kingdom, you know, most high or most highs, you know, simple little changes of plural and singular to, you know, to modify Bible passages. All right, so, you know, do you recognize the pattern? You know, we've talked about this. Remember, there's three levels in the local universe. Individuality at the local system level, associativity at the constellation level, unity at the local universe headquarters level. System capitals are particularly beautified with material and mineral constructions, right? Individuality, matter. Right? Now, whereas, while the universe headquarters are more reflective of spiritual glory, right? The unity, right? See, so, but in the middle, you're going, well, what does this associativity domain do? If you've got matter, you know, really being used on the one end and spirit substance on the other end, what do you do in the middle? Well, there's obviously that artificial fact of Marantia substance, but also living. Okay? As a, you know, I mean, just in the simple sense of there's dead matter, and then there's above that living matter. You know, it's that whole domain of life is in between the end points. And so that's the whole point. That associative domain is being used at the constellation level. And see, and then they say, particularly on the headquarters world, I mean, all of the 770 satellites and sub-satellites are one thing, but the headquarters world, you know, it's living embellishment is what's mostly used, rather than, you know, just Marantia structures, and substance. Okay, so this botanic artistry, to get the Garden of God in one constellation, or the gardens of God in all the constellations in a local universe. All right, what else do they tell us here?
About one half of Edentia is devoted to the exquisite gardens of the Most Highs, and these gardens are among the most entrancing Marantia creations of the local universe. This explains why the extraordinarily beautiful places on the inhabited worlds of Nerdalaishadec are often called the Garden of Eden.
Are so often called the Garden of Eden. Yeah, okay, so, you know, again, quote unquote, in the Bible, the Garden of Eden. You know, and then, you know, like we've talked about, obviously they don't use Hebrew roots for the name of the constellation headquarters world. It isn't literally called Edentia on high. You know, they're calling it Edentia because we have this word Eden that we use for the garden where Adam and Eve were. And again, what does Eden mean, the word Eden mean in Hebrew? I've said it a few times here recently. Does anyone remember now? What is Eden in Hebrew?
Garden.
No. No, it wouldn't be the garden of garden, right? It's the garden of something. It's the garden of delight. Remember delight. Right? Eden means delight in Hebrew. And so when they're saying, that's why they're so often called this, okay, they're so often called the Garden of Delight because the pattern for it at the constellation headquarters, what did they just say? The most entrancing Marantia creations of the local universes. Entrancing. Delightful. Right? Synonym for that word. All right. What they're telling you is whatever name they call this, you know, in local universe tongue or super universe tongue, they're giving you a little hint that it's the designation is indicating how delightful it is. Right? That's the thread of truth in calling it Edentia. Delight. The place of delight. Right? what it literally means, Adentia, the place of delight. That's probably, you know, actually a kind of a transliteration sort of from the local universe tongue. In some way they're saying, they're, the name is the place of delight.
Of course, the tree of life.
Right. The tree of life comes from Adentia, right, all that, right? So all of this botanic artistry gives rise to those trees of life that are translated to worlds, yeah, all that, right? So now just notice one little thing in there, besides the whole bit about how they're trying to teach you about, you know, their use of the word Eden here with delight. They're the most entrancing Marantxa creations of the local universe. Just, you know, they're going to expand on that, but, you know, don't ever forget that that that's the most immediate expression of this association of spirit and matter, the two endpoints into the middle that is a constellation, is that Marantxa substance. So, even if they're using botanic splendor, the whole point of all this artistry is to get you all the more definitively related to Marantxa. Do you remember what the revelators say about the truth of true art? You know, or if I should say, the truth of genuine art. Let's say it that way. That's better. The truth of genuine art here on this planet. You know, what is it that art is, if it's genuine, what is it supposed to be challenging the observer of that art to be doing in their mind?
Worshipping?
No, not worshipping.
Crystallizing.
Striving towards Marantxa consciousness. You remember when they talk about that, about how art is trying to direct your consciousness up to Marantxa?
That the Moda section?
Yeah, when they talk about that, just yeah. If that doesn't ring a bell, do some research and find that passage. It's a good little bit of homework for you to do. Find that passage that relates art to Marantxa. Okay, see that. Where's the pattern for that? Here. Okay. All of the artistry is trying to motivate everyone very definitively to the truth of Marantxa. There's the truth of matter and the truth of spirit on the, you know, on the other endpoints, but we're in the middle now, and it, you know, it's all about Marantxa. Okay.
Centrally located in this magnificent garden is the worship shrine of the Most Highs. The psalmist must have known something about these things, for he wrote, quote, "Who shall ascend the hill of the Most Highs? Who shall stand in this holy place? He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who has not lifted up his soul to vanity nor sworn deceitfully," unquote. At this shrine, the Most Highs, on every 10th day of relaxation, lead all Adentia in the worshipful contemplation of God the Supreme.
So again, you know, just notice how, I think it's Psalm 24, if I remember correctly, you know, they're pointing out this psalmist must have known something. So, you know, again, just like with Moses and Daniel, I mean, there are some things that were part of oral tradition, you know, that were being handed down through peoples from revelators, you know, in various ways at various times. So, they're just reminding you that not all these things are just poetic fabrications. Some of them actually are tied to literal things. And a revelator can be reading, it's like, wait a minute, that's not just any old, that's too close to the facts. That human author obviously had some vague idea of the actual fact of Adentia. Okay? And then that last part is very important, okay? In this shrine for the Most Highs. At this shrine, the Most Highs, on every 10th day of relaxation. Why every 10th day?
It's a week.
Because it's a week, remember? We talked about that. We started this stuff up. You've got a day, and then 10 of those days is a week, and 100 of those days is a year, right? Right. So just like we do, once a week, a Sunday or Saturday, right? They do it every 10th day of relaxation. They have a Sabbath, quote unquote. They lead all Adentia in the worshipful contemplation of God the Father? No. Right. And, you know, when we're here, way up here, long ways away from paper 117, you know, what do they fundamentally mean by God the Supreme? You know, why is it that paper 117 is called God the Supreme rather than, you know, another one about the Supreme Being or something? What's the difference between the Supreme Being and God the Supreme? Right? The Supreme Being is a He. You know, the individuality viewpoint. They take that unity viewpoint designation of God the whatever, like God the Supreme. Who are you really fundamentally? Are you asking them to worship some transcendental fact in the absonite? No. Where are you? In the garden, okay? Is it Father Nature? Or is it Mother Nature? All right. I mean, just like the, you know, paper 117, section 6 is the section on God the Mother. Right? That's the core fact of that individuality of the whole that's being pointed to there. You know, that's a synonym for God the Mother. I mean, fundamentally who they're... The Most Highs are leading everyone in the worshipful contemplation. You notice it's not the worship, so that you don't really think in terms of adoration. You're not trying to talk to another individual. You're trying to put yourself into relationship with the individuality of the whole. Right? Worshipful in just a sense of true worship, you know, minus blending adoration into the worship. The super thinking thing. They're leading everyone, you know, in super thinking. Right? True worship. Self-forgetting, super thinking, worshipful contemplation, getting everyone into the temple, right? And trying to find a greater resonance in the midst of her nature with God the Mother.
The associate of God.
Right? And worshiping God the Mother. All right, communing with, you know, in the sense that I mean by worshiping, they're communing with God the Mother.
Yeah, I find that very intriguing because I've often wondered, what should our relationship be to God the Mother? You know, and it didn't feel right for it to be the same thing as...
No. It's reciprocal. It's really reciprocal. You have a reciprocal relationship to her that you do to him. You know, don't make her another him. Don't create an anthropomorphic God the Mother. An anthropomorphic God the Mother, God the Father, has a measure of truth to it. But an anthropomorphic God the Mother has no truth to it. Right? He's not. Don't think of it as an individual. Right? Trying to commune with the whole and the individuality of the whole. And to do that, you have to cease to be that clamoring part. You have to be self-forgetting, to turn your back on yourself. Right? That clamoring self wants to, you know, have this little oration to the Father, this adoration, this communication, point to point. Okay? No. You're saying, not now. Be still. I want to resonate with the whole now. I want to find my relationship to God the Mother. You know, and it means I have to let go of some thought of trying to focus in on a laser beam that is the Father. I need to let go of that. I need to let go of that individuality and actually find some resonance with the whole. And the more we ascend, the more we'll be able to do this better and better. And you'll eventually start to have not just a feeling of actuality, but a feeling of reality in that worshipful contemplation. You'll begin to feel the presence of a person in that hole. Right? Not just the spirit, you know, or spirit-mind presence, but the actual person. Especially now, post-Pentecost, when this first mother that we can try to strike step with is Creative Mother Spirit, you know, to begin to actually feel her personal presence. And then to be able to feel the personal presence of the super universe mother and higher mothers, right? You can only do that if you actually resonate with the whole, not just two-thirds of the whole or some tiny little part that can be standing somewhere like a father being, right? But the whole.
It was recognized that George Washington in the morning set time aside to go in the room by himself for what he called his devotions.
Mm-hmm. Right.
He never divulged what those devotions were, but I was always struck by that.
Wasn't he a Puritan or something like that? What was his religion? Wasn't he a Puritan?
People thought he was an atheist.
What was he?
Well, I mean,
a Mason.
Right. I mean, there's, yeah. But just, you know, it's a valid point. I mean, Gene is bringing that up because he's just reflecting on what I was just saying there. I mean, it sounds like he wasn't trying to just do this point-to-point communication thing. Right? The very fact that he might not believe so much in the anthropomorphic monotheistic God would have helped him to actually find the mother.
A lot of people thought he was an atheist.
Right? Right. So you're a very father-like expression? And when you lead worship, do you lead the worship God the Father? No, look at that. Who do you lead the worship towards? You just notice that. Yeah. They know, because they're very father-like expressions, they could get out of balance. They could get too biased to the Father. And they need to make sure they take special effort to consecrate their mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother and not get totally fixated on the Father. They make a special effort to keep their consecration twofold. The consecration of the Father is kind of just built into them. You don't even have to work at that. They're very father-like expressions. So they know they need to work at their consecration to the universal harmony, to God the Mother. See, so that's why they're doing that. All right.
The architectural worlds enjoy 10 forms of life of the material order. On Urantia, there is plant and animal life. But on such a world as Adentia, there are 10 divisions of the material orders of life. Were you to view these 10 divisions of Adentia life, you would quickly classify the first 3 as vegetable and the last 3 as animal, but you would be utterly unable to comprehend the nature of the intervening 4 groups of prolific and fascinating forms of life.
It's again just, you know, just to notice there's the 10, right? The 10 forms of physical energy. Right? So this is a significant little clue how they're matching up those 10 forms, 3 on the one end being, you know, more attuned to the kind of energy that's associated with plants, 3 on the other end more attuned to animals, and a combination in between. See, that's some clues about the central universe and the tenfold pattern and stuff. Okay, so just they're about to tell you we can't actually think about the details at all because it's completely beyond our comprehension. But you can notice that. It's the tenfold pattern. That mysterious 10 forms of physical energy thing is manifesting here. And you can get your hands on it a little bit. Okay?
Even the distinctively animal life is very different from that of the evolutionary worlds. So different that it is quite impossible to portray to mortal minds the unique character and affectionate nature of these non-speaking creatures. There are thousands upon thousands of living creatures which your imagination could not possibly picture. The whole animal creation is of an entirely different order from the gross animal species
Wow.
of the evolutionary planets. But all this animal life is most intelligent and exquisitely serviceable, and all the various species are surprisingly gentle and touchingly companionable. There are no carnivorous creatures on such architectural worlds. There is nothing in all Edentia to make any living being afraid.
Okay, so the difference between what can evolve and what can be just made, you know, what can just be designed and built by the life carriers on an architectural world. You know, just think about the logic of it. You know, these are some very, very complex, refined creatures. I mean, you can't evolve finery like that. I mean, the evolutionary process is a pretty coarse process, right? You know, gross, coarse, like they're saying there, right? See, so the animals that we know are gross, are coarse in nature because it's a very crude process, the evolutionary process. It doesn't have micro tweezers. But if you actually do make an animal, you know, in that way that can't be evolved in this refined way, it's so different. See, I mean, they're saying, you know, you can't even remotely extrapolate the animals that you know and get anything that's like any of this stuff. Even animals that we can't even imagine. You notice this, you know, it's not that they aren't going to try. It says, you know, your imagination could not possibly picture. It's not even a potential. Right? Okay, so even animals, I mean, again, be so humble about thinking that your experiences here are telling you something about ultimate reality.
Nothing.
Right? It's almost nothing. Even analogous, right, you know, that we're experiencing right now. Not even animals. Right? So it's just very, you know, some of these statements are very startling in their consequences. Just, you know, to bring in the humility, you know, don't absolutize your thoughts right now. I mean, they're just so rudimentary. They're so gross. You know, they're so coarse, so crude, so shadowy.
But could you imagine it how we think some of our animals are so gorgeous?
Right.
Could you imagine what they must be up there?
Right. See, yeah. And that's remember that they point that out occasionally, right? I mean, the things that you think are beautiful, objectively, they call ugly. Right? I mean, we just have to recognize this. I mean, that's why they say, you know, those most beautiful things you've ever imagined and produced relative to religion? We call those things grotesque. I mean, that's the contrast we're talking about. Not only is it beyond imagination, but because it's beyond our imagination, it's the difference between ugly and beautiful. Right? It's actually objectively ugly what we call subjectively beautiful.
Yes.
That's how little we understand. Okay? So very humbly we walk through life. Right? Life is nothing but suggestions of truth. It's not the fact, right? It's just a remote suggestion of what beauty will, you know, the experience with beauty that you'll one day have. So be willing to let go of all things and let all things become new at some point. Yeah. And then you finally get into full relationship with the completeness of beauty in the finite age. Not only beauty, but truth and goodness as well. And then what do they tell you about those three? It's like, well, you transcend all of that in the absinthe. right?
Something much more
to something that we don't even have words for, right? That make truth, beauty, and goodness at the grand universe completed scale seem like nothing.
Well, there's the central,
right? Right. So it's just, you know, the humility they're trying to get us to identify with here. Okay.
The vegetable life is also very different from that of Urantia, consisting of both material and Urantia varieties. Material growths have a characteristic green coloration, but the Urantia equivalent of vegetative life have a violet or orchid tinge of varying hue and reflection. Such Maurantia vegetation is purely an energy growth. When eaten, there is no residual portion.
All right, so that, you know, and that just brings in, like we said so many times, all these mysterious things about Maurantia substance. You know, I mean, so it's you know, when they say orchid, you know, they mean there's more red, right? It's more like purple, right? So, so it's violet to, you know, to reddish violet. And that's the complement of what we have with the green and photosynthesis, right? So you're still doing photosynthesis and everything with material plants. You've got the green, chlorophyll, and all that. But then why do you have this violet orchid? I remember again, what other violet hue do we have? You know, material sons and daughters. Right. Right, so this whole bit about the relationship between mechanical mind, you know, at that highest level that's producing that luminosity in the material sons and daughters, as it interacts with the physical, and this relationship to Maurantia, see, that's the fact that a Maurantia, as a Maurantia being, you can drink material water, and somehow it doesn't just pour on the ground, somehow it goes into your body. Right, all of this mysterious connection between physical energy and Maurantia energy, and yeah.
So those Maurantia bodies will be contained.
Yeah,
they're not going to be just like.
Right, they're not going to be, fuzzy. You know, they won't fade off into fuzzy luminosity or something. No, right, you have a skin. Yeah, just like here. This.
That I cannot
imagine. Right. Right,
and
Adam, you understand all this stuff, and right, and you're about to see some amazing. This is understood by not just Adam and Eve, but something that you wouldn't immediately expect understands these things. Here, let's read.
Being endowed with 10 divisions of physical life, not to mention the Maurantia variations. These architectural worlds provide tremendous possibilities for the biologic beautification of the landscape and of the material and Maurantia structures. The celestial artisans direct the native Spermatia in this extensive work of botanic decoration and biologic embellishment, whereas your artists must resort to inert paint and lifeless marble to portray their concepts. The celestial artisans and the Univitatia more frequently utilize living materials to represent their ideas and to capture their ideals.
Okay, Spermatia, right? They're not even personalities, right? They're just animals, very fancy animals, material animals. Okay, they tell you about, when you read about this for Spermatia, they tell you that they can see all the lower orders of celestial beings. Well, they can do more than that. They have to dig in the Maurantia gardens. They can, you know, manipulate a Maurantia plant. Yeah, you know? So it's not just seeing, they can interact with it. So how fancy an animal are they? Right now, I don't have to worry about anything touching my soul, right? You know, it seems to be have no relationship to material stuff at all directly. You know, here we have our animal gardeners, you know, digging holes and putting in Maurantia plants. Okay, I mean, so they can actually manipulate all this stuff. Lots of mystery there.
Now, these are the same Spermatia that are on the mansion world.
On every world in the local universe.
And they're the ones that become, they're the only things that are reincarnated.
Right, all that stuff, yeah, we'll get to. Right.
And they're really cool, and they're a cross between a rabbit and a horse.
No,
or
a horse.
And again, that cross, is that actually true based upon the previous paragraph? About the coarse, gross? No.
Yeah.
Right. See, again, I mean, you can't even imagine what a Spermatia looks like. They're beyond your imagination.
It's a kangaroo and a platypus.
I mean, again, how far beyond our imagination is this animal if it actually can handle Maurantia substance? See, that's not gross. That's not coarse. That's some sort of incredibly refined.
There. The vertical depth of personality.
Right. Very, very. The more they read about what they say about the Marantia, the more Marantia substance, the more confused you get. It's very confusing to try to understand how the physics of all this, how this all works. Yep.
When they talk about it, them being a cross between what a dog and a horse, are, it's not the physical aspects; it's their
character. Right. 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 Yes. Right. They're just trying to give you some sense, perhaps, of the mindedness.
I can't
yes.
With those animals.
Okay, now the little things they throw in here, just notice that they're having fun here. So like celestial artisans. Okay, it's one thing for to have lifeless marble. You know, you're in your mind, oh yeah, marble, you know, a lot of times has shells from once living creatures in it. Okay, so that's a little play. So instead of using dead, you know, marble, they use living marble, quote unquote. But the fun one is the inert paint. Okay.
I can relate to that so much.
Okay, so this whole bit about how crude we are. Okay. We have a lot of, we think, very refined artists who have painted things, like Michelangelo. Painted very spiritual things, very artful things. Okay, what does the word inert literally mean?
Stupid?
No, no. No, what does ert literally mean? You don't, I know you don't know. In means not, ert means art.
Oh.
Not art, paint. That's how not art our art is.
Wow. Oh
my. It's not art, art.
Not art.
Not art, art.
That means paint is a hassle.
Right, right. I mean, you're trying to invoke a relationship to Marantia with something that's fundamentally not art. That's how much we struggle here. That's how frustrated an artist might be with his materials. Okay, that's what they're doing, playing in there. All right, so again, when we're going to read it, we're going to read about the celestial artisans in the next paper. Just a little reminder there. Again, you can't even imagine what it means to be an artisan up there. So all the analogies they do in that paper, right, just like analogizing to dogs and dolphins and chimpanzees and whatnot, right? Not very close.
Incredible.
Okay. All right, one more little thing here.
If you enjoy the flowers, shrubs, and trees of Urantia, then you will feast your eyes upon the botanical beauty and the floral grandeur of the supernal gardens of Edentia. But it is beyond my powers of description to undertake to convey to the mortal mind an adequate concept of these beauties of the heavenly worlds. Truly, eye has not seen such glories as await your arrival on these worlds of the mortal ascension adventure.
Last sentence, tip of the hat to what?
Paul.
Paul, right?
For
right, right. First Corinthians. Right, First Corinthians. I mean, there's no quotes there. Right, again, do they expect you to know your Bible? Yes, they do. Right? You should know your Bible. Because they want you to feel something there. That's a very famous passage. It stirs the heart of man. Right? They want you to be stirred there. You know, and if you know not the Bible, you're dead when you read that, right? They want you to be alive when you read that. Just a little reminder. Jesus knew the scriptures. So there you have it. Yep, the gardens of God. And, you know, the really significant stuff you noticed is what's sort of between the lines. We're always looking for that. Look for what they're saying, you look, follow the deductive consequences of the things that they say, always, so that you can begin to come into a living relationship with this. Don't just read the words and treat them as facts. Try to strike step with them and say, well, what does that imply? And most of the time, the things that you run into about the implications of what you're beginning to digest, it leads you to humility. Right? One of the things that we all need, especially if you have any spiritual consciousness. Your first goal in life with your spiritual consciousness is to find and embrace humility, lest you go down the path of Lucifer. Right? So don't be afraid, you know, to face the humbling statements in the revelation. Take those on. Doesn't diminish you in the eyes of God one bit to be a lowly beginning child of God. All right, so the next time we'll get more into what we're doing as ascenders. There, we've worked through all of the what's the stage like. Now we're going to talk about what we do as actors upon that stage next time. All right, let's take a moment here.